Well, I guess we should start by talking a bit about this show that you're preparing for here at Camden. It's a collaboration between you and Felix Gonzalez Torres, is that correct?
And Ed Reinhardt, to the extent that it's a collaboration, and to the extent that we can presume the happy cooperation of those no longer with us. But in fact, art is made up very much of the questionable, as far as happy or not, collaboration of the non-living. I think that the premise of the exhibition, which came really out of a conversation between Maureen Paley and myself, was one in which I felt myself that there was an attempt being begun to sort of reframe Reinhardt, which really very much bothered me, and it went to the heart, really, of a practice such as mine. And in some ways, of course, this is where I speak very personally, but it in some ways, the attempt to re-Greenbergerize Reinhardt was in some sense, for me, an attempt on the part of certain individuals to sort of sever my links to a certain larger context of art practice in America, which I very much came out of. And then I had sort of objections on a sentimental level about Reinhardt being abused and being put back in a group that he really detested and which were, in his lifetime, very much opposed to him. And by basically people who spend time in libraries trying to shore up their own point of view without any real relation to the larger context of which real people live lives and work. It comes out of that situation very concretely. So that was very much in the air. There was a feeling I think Maureen had that it was my doing some kind of exhibition in London. It was way overdue, and so she asked me what I would want to do since there was some interest of some kind of exhibition with me, and I proposed this. There was an idea, somewhat related idea of an exhibition. Which would have happened near the time of the Reinhardt retrospective at MoMA, and it was a feeling by Rita, the widow of Ed Reinhardt, and Anna, his daughter, that they didn't want to do anything which would sort of steal the thunder from MoMA, which I took as a compliment. But so there was some concern to do if they did something, it should be done later. So this is what has come out of it, and we've had their support for the exhibition as well. So we do feel Ad's presence in many ways here, even though he's not with us.
So that, in a sense, seems to concern your historical placement, as it were, your relationship to Reinhardt. Following that, how does the collaboration with Felix Gonzalez Torres relate to your conception for the exhibition?
Well, in the same way that, if we talk about my relation with Felix, is in somewhat very strongly felt by me, the same way I discuss my relationship with Ed Reinhardt. And so for me, the two conversations are very comfortable. It's part of the same. And I think that one has to really understand that, and you see some references to this in Reinhardt's work in the exhibition. He talks about his relationship with younger artists. And he was extremely kind to me, and as a young, unknown sort of kid, you know. And when I first saw the work of Felix, I felt very strong sympathy toward it. I really felt that he was dealing with the issues that I saw them, I saw as being the important ones, and approaching it in ways that were, for me, very productive. The kind of problem, with a certain understanding of the intelligently internalized relationship to the, so to say, the certain political questions that must be manifest in work, and avoiding the traps, the work such as someone like Hans Hacke, whose politics I support, but have great deal of problem with the work that comes out of that. As a kind of perhaps negative example to be of the way in which one certain things have to be avoided, I think. And Felix, I think, did that well, and still his work is really has deeply entrenched in the same kinds of issues, and but I think dealing with them in ways far more interesting. And he, of course, always cited me as someone important in that development. I didn't, of course, know that when I saw his work, and I've tried to be helpful in the ways that I have the possibility of being helpful with the younger artists' work. So when the idea that came out of three generations, which have a sort of similarly, you know, interesting my relation to Reinhardt and his relation to me, I ended up being a sort of bridge between those two. And it's interesting to see, to think of Felix Gonzalez Torres in relation to Ed Reinhardt, because, see, that's what's, for me, it's interesting about the whole exhibition, is that because it's not based on certain presumptions about art, which have to do with form, color, or morphology, well, immediately doesn't see the connections. I mean, a lot of people know them, in my case, in relation to Reinhardt. But, and, of course, it doesn't take too much figuring out to see the relation between Felix and I. But the three of us together, I think, is very instructive. And it's really a certain kind of, an aspect of a kind of conceptual practice manifested in three quite distinct ways, ways which are, I think, authentic in their own terms, but at the same time share a larger culture. And you see the way in which a younger artist or another generation will pull aspects out of an older artist's work. And in some ways continue a certain kind of cultural life for that work, even though you want certain things are left behind in terms of what's not used. The fact that this exhibition and the catalog, which is, I think, a very important part of this exhibition too, takes really, in some sense, is manifested. This is certainly not its sole point, but it is one point, that it represents a critique of the MoMA retrospective and the extremely objectionable text, from my point of view, of Yves Alain Poix. So this is really, I think, much more honest to Reinhardt, to the practice of Reinhardt, and really to what Reinhardt's work came to mean.
So how is the show conceived? Given that, as you say, you're not dealing really with a specific set of objects that one can approach in terms of form, shape, colour, and so on, not the kind of traditional exhibition. What actually are you doing to produce this critique of Reinhardt's reappropriation, as it were, or attempted reappropriation?
Yeah, happily it wasn't as successful, and I don't think, because it's just too far from the reality of the man, his work, and his life. But you begin with, this is what I got out of Reinhardt, and I think this is what Felix got out of me, that artists really work with meaning, and which is not exactly the same to saying it's simply a signifying activity, but that one, of course, you use what you use, and in every artist's work, one assumes that certain conditions are set up in which people are organized to perceive meaning due to the way the work is constructed. But there are certain presumptions about the nature of things within that category, includes art, of which the work of course is reflecting on. What this exhibition, I think, very much points to is the ways in which one can approach the practice of someone like Reinhardt, and I use him as the example here, as the older artist, the one, in some sense, being as he is a painter and can be claimed by a certain practice, still at the same time defined in some ways the beginning of another kind of practice, perhaps not, you know, shall we say, latent in his work, and pulled out, I guess, primarily by me, but certainly others were sympathetic to that act. To then provide the possibility of an extended meaningful cultural life for the work outside of the generation and in which he's generally understood to be part of. That is, in fact, I think, an important part about art and its richness, its availability to artists, and the way in which the work continues to remain viable and alive, and again, to be not to be too solipsistic, but meaningful.
How is the show being structured? What actually will the show consist of?
Beginning with Ed Reinhardt, we have three of his black paintings chosen because of the way in which Reinhardt himself, I think, esteemed his own work and considered best representation of his practice as an artist. A painting from the earliest painting is from 1953, which was one of the earliest black paintings done. That is to say, in the the same approach that the later works were, except it's not square; it's about 80 by 60 rather than 60 square. It was once owned by Frank Stella, so that for me is an interesting connection. And then the other two are the ultimate paintings of the square variety, one from 1960 and one from 1966. One of them being from the Tate Gallery. So you get to see one that you own here, which apparently hasn't been seen too much. We were very happy to have the support of Nicholas Sirota on this, and it was, I think, important that one, a Reinhardt that is here, that is part of a collection here, an important collection like the Tate, would be part of the exhibition. So that we're happy about that. The work also, see, normally that's where the story would end. That is to say, you have the black paintings and that should be the end of the story. One of the points being made here is that for many of the artists who came after Reinhardt, those black paintings, the experience of those black paintings, are framed strongly by the rest of his activity as an artist. The texts that he wrote, the cartoons that he did, his teaching, his presence on panel discussions, and his lectures, and the general establishment of within the New York art context of a kind of intellectual presence, protected those black paintings, which at times could have been appropriated by various movements. They were at one point seen as part of the op art context and other things. But because of that writing, because of his total production as an artist, those propositions, those black painted propositions, were understood in the right way. That is to say, they constituted a particular kind of meaning because of the totality of his practice. And that was, for me, was a very important thing that I learned from Reinhardt, and that was partly why I forced myself to write as well, and to teach as well, and not simply to think that I was an artist only because of the propositions that I put into the world as to what art might be, but also the meaning that I fought for that to become art, that play within the meaning system of art. The play alone, I don't think, is enough to do it. Certainly not at this end of the 20th century.
Something slid by that I think I'd quite like you to expand a little bit on, which was your statement about the propositions that you put into the world about what art might be, which in an earlier frame of reference, I guess, might be understood as works of art. This is precisely what you're talking about. Reinhardt is doing is not simply making objects, but actually constituting a practice, and that this is fundamentally what you're doing, and that you would never see anything that you did as being simply making another work of art. You're always making some proposition about what people might think of as being art.
Right, which is about the idea of the artist as a political being. Our responsibility to the community in which these things are offered is meaningful, right? And that the artist then takes responsibility for the production of that meaning. I think this is very important. And if you want to make a contrast, a good one would be between Ed Reinhardt and Robert Ryman. The difference is as simple as black and white. Ryman has nothing to say really about his work. He doesn't frame it with writing. He doesn't frame it with any other kind of intellectual production. He stands mute in the expressionist monographic tradition and permits gallerists, critics, particular breed of neoconservative critics like Yvan Lambois or Thierry de Duve, for example, to make the meaning in some sense for the work. And everything based on the idea that it is the part of a grand painting continuum, without whatever radical break it may have made in some point in the 60s, that certainly a radical break does not stay broken, as it were. And other work came along which located that work very, very much. And it seemed, and so in the sense, you ended up with, in the case of Ryman, a white screen in which a lot of theory can be projected, and the works do not interfere. Nice white middle-class academics love this work in the same way that the art historical sort of managerial class loves expressionist paintings of artists who just do work in the studio and never say, have another word to say, and then with this nature, they can then make culture. And when artists actually fight for the meaning of their work, as Reinhardt did, as I've always done, another example would be Joseph Beuys, who I've certainly a lot of problems with, but as I've mentioned elsewhere, it's interesting how someone like Benjamin Buchlow hates Beuys. And this generation of critics, it's an old, very conservative aspect of criticism in art historical writing, but artists who won't let them produce the meaning for their work are really badly treated. And artists who write are it's like we don't stay in our place. And this is quite interesting and in fact very contradictory if you consider some of the supposed political objectives being alluded to by some of these writers. The reality of their practice is often very conservative and in a couple of cases downright dishonest. So they somehow use that role of the art historian slash critic still as some kind of objective force of defining history when it suits them, right? And then play the ideologue or polemicist at the next moment if it suits them. It's a little bit of a crisis, I think, now in art historical fields, writing on contemporary art, because it's you realize that the career needs of an art historian are really very not very much different than that of an artist, and except that we take subjective responsibility for our cultural production, whereas the art historian can play this kind of role of being the objective organizer of reality here in relation to the cultural production.
Most famous statement, the dictum of Reinhardt's, is this point about art being art as art and everything else is everything else. That is something that is absolutely at the basis of your own work too.
In a very particular way, it has to be understood that before art can be understood as being useful in terms of our understanding of larger cultural mechanisms, we have to know what it is, right? And the point of the work in the early, middle 60s that was done using tautologies was to see how an artwork works, see how culture works, to isolate it and see how it functions. There was the word function came up a lot at that time. I did an early text of mine about function in an early work. The tautology in art, of course, told us a lot more than the usual understanding of a tautology when it's applied to its the context in which one normally finds that as something to use as a model. And I think that that was, for me, was quite an interesting thing, was because of all that supposed, I never really saw it as being art for art in that way, but I felt that one had to begin with looking at what art was and separating it from a lot of other things. Particularly, you have to understand, we were just preceded by, remember, this is a very New York story, abstract expressionism and pop art, and there was a real need to clear away a lot of other things which were, the early stages of infotainment had to be done away with to really just to see, in some sense, the bones of the dilemma.
To what extent did you, at that time, see what you were doing, the kinds of things that I suppose, came to fruition were expressed in the late 60s text, Start After Philosophy. To what extent did you see your kinds of manoeuvres then as being related to other things that were happening in New York, other kinds of ideas that were being put forward, which were also attempting to separate art, as was being made in New York at the time, from a kind of European aesthetic tradition? I mean, obvious ones would be the pronouncements of someone like Donald Judd, yeah, or the kinds of things that Stella said about his black paintings, rather than maybe necessarily the paintings themselves. Again, a kind of rejection of an aesthetic tradition. I mean, to what extent did you feel yourself connected with that kind of thing?
You would identify with it and want to improve upon it, you know. I certainly, you have to remember there was in fact a kind of hegemony of Grunbergian movers and thinkers going on, and the history that was of art, be it a local, or even someone could say even a provincial one, of which I did see useful. There was definitely for me useful aspects to pop art, particularly Warhol, and a certain kind of detachment that got away from the erratic. Remember, we were beginning to read Walter Benjamin at that point, and that was something that was interesting. I took objection to them retooling them and continuing to function as paintings. That was problematic. But certainly there was a real fear in which the kind of art, the relevant history as I saw it, was being an attempt to marginalize it, what Greenberg called novelty art, that the Grunbergians were like running the museums, they were on the grant giving panels, they were on, you know, running university art departments. I mean, it was it was a serious situation, we thought. And Art After Philosophy was very much written as, that's why it's been accused of being sort of, in a way, crypto-formalist itself. Well, part of the, as agitprop theory, part of its role was to locate itself on the turf of Greenberg and Fried and them, and use this kind of pseudoscientific language to turn everything on its head. And I think it did that quite successfully. It unfortunately makes it, dates it as a read, as useful as it was at that time. But it was very much part of that context. My immediate influences besides Reinhardt were clearly a consideration, not so much an attraction to the exegesis of his work, but the implications of some of Duchamp's activities were, I thought, a rich, if dated minefield, that's a slip, field in which one could do a lot of digging, right? But certainly the work, the immediate influence was, of course, so-called minimal artists, of which people had their own kinds of ways of influencing. I mean, influencing us. Certainly, for me, immediately Judd's work and writing, for me, there was the two, one without the other would have not been so interesting. It was, again, what I learned from Reinhardt in that regard, that the two together were, I thought, formidable. He said many things such as, everything sculpture has, my work doesn't. My work is neither painting nor sculpture. Now, these things, of course, have all been forgotten, and the work became sculpture, essentially. This, of course, was the weakness of minimal art and what I thought we had improved. But there was in terms of the work that my generation did after it, or my context, whatever. We left a lot of things behind. The fact that, I mean, I like to give examples. I think it's relevant to look within the so-called real world as art is represented. The fact, for example, the Saatchi collection skips over us. It goes from minimal art and goes to neoconception, but none of us are in that collection. And if you look around, you see that a lot in America. And this is not I'm not lamenting it. It only means in some ways how well we did our job. What we were seen as not collectible for a very, very long time. And still in some circles, you know. I mean, now it's been around 25 years. People are beginning to realize that it's part of the history, part of the story, and that it has to be manifested there in that story somehow. So they're trying to catching up. But it was, as the best example, I think, and the best way of talking about conceptual art, as I think the way Terry Atkinson discusses it, which has to do with the failure of it. And in that sense, its failure, of course, it was part of its integrity. And that is not to say that we don't continue working. But it defines in some way an understanding about the kind of contribution any artist can make, and that it underscores the fact that being an artist is about a process, that there was no attempt to make a masterpiece that would, in one work, depict the world. That, in fact, one has the debris of a process that is left behind, and the totality of that process perhaps adds up to something that's meaningful. But I never expected any one work to answer all of my problematic as an artist, all the questions I have as a man in the world, all different things I do succeed in an extremely limited way or fail in a very instructive way. Some of the works I like the most are some of the most perhaps spectacular failures. Should be the nature of the artistic process. That's what I call a play within the meaning system of art. And it's quite another thing than to make works in a signature style. That for me, there was something, I've said this before, there's something problematic about the fact that all that work in the 60s, you see now, that somehow in the end, Judd has to make boxes. Andre's got to put something on the floor. Flavin's got to use fluorescent lights. Buren's got to do a stripe, and Lawrence Wiener has to do a one-liner on the wall. And it's just, it's a little bit like the shape of the Coca-Cola bottle. It's about product identification. It's about intellectual property identification as well. I always respected Naumann as far as away as his work is from me, because he also is not afraid of engaging in that play. And you do works that, if one looks at the works I've done, of the various installations documented to Venice, to the Champollion project in France, it reminds me very much of when I was much younger, and I looked at all those works, the proto investigations, from Neon to whatever, and I even had visitors from others, and they would say, this is like a group show here. We don't see any central vision as an artist, because it wasn't functioning on that level in which art usually functions in that way. And so, after 25 years of doing things a certain way, clearly it's identifiable to many people what my work is. But I think that in a significant other way than it is some of my colleagues I've made reference to.
This process that you're talking about, the play, is absolutely not unitary in any kind of sense. It's always conversational, it's always dialogical. You're always dealing with other people and their propositions.
People have asked, what is the major material of your work? And people always expect me to say language, but I say context. And of course, for me, the best material, if you want to continue with that analogy, that showed maximum flexibility was that kind of the linguistic aspect of operating within a context. And so, that has come up a lot. And of course, it was been in my work consistently. But as you'll see, when I use, the point being is that I work with language, not with words, and which is a defining characteristic between me and colleagues of mine in this exhibition here at Camden. You see the photography is stronger perhaps than the text, but it functions linguistically, and you don't even notice really the difference between the text and the photos. They are working so well together that there is no priority of one to the other, which you normally find in photo text kinds of works.
When you were talking about the early texts and the work in the 60s, you used this word function, like what is art's function? And during the 70s, maybe, that was a word which was on everyone's lips. Everyone was attempting to think about what that was. But it certainly is a kind of idea that's dropped out, it seems to me, in the last decade or so, the sense that art might have a function. Is there something here again in what you're attempting to do to readdress this question, or to keep the kind of question at the forefront, that one is always talking about some sort of responsibility on the part of... Yeah. Yourself as an activist in this area. And one would again similarly see a relationship to the kind of work that Felix Gonzalez Torres is doing.
You see that Felix is completely another generation. He's from another even cultural context within the larger American one than I am. Being Cuban, being gay, as the texture of his life has been significantly different than mine. However, you see his approach to the kind of work he's doing because of that life, and really interesting combinations of differences and similarities between his work and mine. Things he arrived at, works he arrived at, which I had done, you know, maybe 10 or 15 years before, that he was not even aware of. I mean, it came out in the process of doing this exhibition, although we've known each other for a few years. But we, Chris, working on the show, spent a lot more time together and discussed a lot more things and talked about work, and, you know, that he did, which were incredibly parallel to works of mine. You know, all the work I did in billboards and public media in the 68 second investigation, some of which he did not know about at all, and did quite related works, and at the same time, part of his thinking and the rationale is very similar to mine, and other aspects of it is completely different, totally his, authentic to his particular context, etc. And that for me is that is the kind of rich continuity that one, at least I find very interesting and. You don't want to say something like life-affirming, but something like that comes to mind.
Your reference to Terry Atkinson's point about failure also seems to suggest certain kinds of possible tie-ins with other younger American artists at the moment. I'm thinking of people like Mike Kelly or John Miller, both, again, who not only make things, but also are writing quite consistently as a means of providing a context for what they're doing.
I think this is important, and this is one of the things some members, colleagues of mine from the old days, are wondering why I'm supportive of a lot of younger artists because they, you know, don't quite get it in some cases. And I think that I find if you compare the work that we were seeing in the Transavanguardia, wild painting, whatever generation. And you see this work, you know, there's an enormous difference in terms of the attitude of artists about what the work process is. Some of the most conservative models reemerged in the work like Schnabel or Kia or Baselitz or Lupertz or whatever. And I think that one of the things that you were talking about earlier, which in response to what I had said, I would give as a model about this sense of the working process as being important. It's as if you were on one side of a highway, and a friend of yours was on the others, and they stopped and they went to find cigarettes or something like this, and they can't hear you, and they're yelling out, or you're yelling out to them, trying to tell them to buy some cigarettes, and you'd yell the same message in different ways, but the noise of the cars were sort of eclipsing what you were saying, and you'd use hand signals. And not one of those things got the message through, but in the overlap of all the different ways you did it, the message would be there. And rather than the idea of making one perfect picture that said it all in one statement. And for me, that is like the difference of understanding of the practice, and that it takes place over a period of time and isn't done all at once. And this is, I think, an important distinction between how an artist sees art, experiences art, and how art historians, we're talking about not all art historians, are certainly exceptions to the characterization I'm making here, but generally with the sense of the professional institution of art historians and criticism that comes out of that. It always, because of the internalization, I think, of the exact sciences in the university, a desire to make this process static, reduce it to facts and objects, and make it in that sense accessible to a market, and be a certain level of connoisseurship and a certain idea of qualification of higher and lower forms and all that kind of stuff comes out of that, is a different approach to what art's about and what the nature of the activity is. And so there is that conflict. And this later generation, the need to write about your art, to fight and struggle for the meaning of your activity, other than simply making objects and sending them mutely out into the world / market, certainly goes back to what we started. And I'm sorry, but that gives me a great deal of optimism about this crisis in the whole activity, that whether art will simply become expensive decoration, sort of neckties for over the couch, or in fact has the hope to be seen as a more serious activity. And at this point, I look to the practice of individual artists first. That, by the way, wild painting history we were talking about, what's interesting to see the alternative to that history. While those men were doing those big phallocentric paintings, there was a whole practice emerging by women that was, just perfectly the alternative and the other to that. And, I mean, I think when one looks at the work of the 80s, that's going to be the work that was important without any question. And so that's, part of the enrichment of this. When we, in the 60s, it was still very much the men, although we had certainly conceptual art, had Christine Kozloff and Hanna Darboven, don't remain to be known as figures in the movement as much. Hanna, of course, just in some regards, to the extent that her work was able to be useful to the market and presented within those kinds of contexts, she continued to have a cultural life. But it's, that is a difference, for one. There are some important differences. That's one that strikes one immediately.
In a sense, it is a mark of the success of much of that activity, that it really was radically uncollectible, that it was so much a process, that there was never any... It defies the whole notion of making a collection, that there is one object which is a better one to collect than another one, that you can't actually say, yes, I'll have that and put it in to complete this kind of history.
I once was in the Loft building with Robert Mapplethorpe before he was known. And throughout the 70s, Robert was always asking me what my work sold for. And, and it was always a lot more than his. And he would say, God, and I'm a real photographer, And so at a certain point you get, I'm told that my work's the most expensive of the conceptual artists. But then how expensive is that? You think about whether it's a photo in a chair or whatever, it's still less than a drawing by Eric Fischel in the late 80s, at what point, what is expensive or cheap in relation to the insanity of the whole market system anyway? I always had somewhat mixed feelings about the market in that regard, because I knew part of the reason I went to Castelli Gallery in 1969, I was 24 years old, and it was where all my heroes showed, and I was happy to be there on some personal grounds, although I was really full of doubt about it. But I knew that in the very American context, that people could not ignore this activity of art if I was in that gallery. And in a place in which we still remained uncollected for the next 15, 20 years, it still had to be taken account of. It still had to be given, taken seriously as an activity, validified in all those kind of ways we would find problematic. It was just simply necessary. And it seemed to me that it was important, a very tight line one had to walk on to be part of the solution and not part of the problem, but still have your hands on the microphone. That is, be able to speak and to be able to maintain a critical presence and to articulate a difference. And during the time of the Fox, we had a lot of what we called in New York Soho Leninists, who of course were farther to the left than anybody imaginable, and pure as hell, and completely irrelevant. We see what happened to that and what came out of it. And I simply realized that this was just strategically kind of infantilism and not at all useful. Maybe I had a little bit of a proprietary relationship with this thing called conceptual art and felt very much that I had to be its protector and fight for it and all that. People, of course, turned that into a simple personal aggrandizement. I have never seen it that way. But its fortune certainly, in some ways, would rise or fall, depending on how well I was doing in terms of my own work. Not exclusively, but to some degree, that was always the case. And so this was put on me as much as I promoted it myself, this thought. So I did make the decision to work within this existing meaning distribution system of the gallery and museum world. Certainly in 68, we had lots of ideas that we could burn all that down, and it was completely romantic hogwash, I think. You know, it wouldn't work. And so by doing that, I think that we've had some effect on the nature of the practice of art at this end of the 20th century. I think if you look at the major exhibitions, a group and individual of the last 30 years, the presence of what we began in the 60s is very strong. Others learn from our failures in a very successful way, and as well as we did in terms of our own work and its ability to continue to reevaluate what the practice of art is, questioning the nature of art, as I put it all those many years ago.
And yet, for all that, there still are enormous areas in which there is an entrenched conservatism that the kind of activity that you're engaged in really needs to address. I mean, in purely artistic terms, you've already mentioned the reappearance of macho painting at the end of the 70s, during the 80s. But a much more recent example would be the exhibition you organized in Brooklyn, which was very much addressed towards the conservative pro-censorship campaign in America.
What that show could show was that most of the collections in the United States would have problems being really exhibited, many of the work, based on new criteria being established by the Congress for the National Endowment of the Arts. Once my exhibition there got funding by the NEA, I could not take that money without trying, should we say, to save the NEA, even if they didn't want to be saved the way we had in mind. I think we succeeded in really showing the absurdity of that, it was a perfect context, because the Brooklyn Museum had been essentially an ethnographic museum. They changed the labels at the beginning of the century, and it went from being science to art. But it really was like an enormous attic of the world's culture, many of the things. I had to work with 7 curators of a different department who did not want to show many of the things, because they didn't think they were the best examples, whatever. They had their own professional criteria. To pull these things out really showed that the history of art, in some ways, the history of cultural problematicity in many ways.
The title of the show, The Play of the Unmentionable, is very close to one you'd organized maybe a year, 18 months earlier in Vienna and then in Brussels, right. The Play of the Unsayable, to commemorate the centenary of Wittgenstein's birth. What kinds of connections do you see between those two shows?
It was, of course, ironic, and it was the idea of play, because I wanted to be, in a certain sense, as a work of mine, and understood as, while that may or may not be interesting, that it is a work of mine, its location is appropriately behind and to the side of the value of it as an exhibition. And that, for me, was important, to take a practice and put it out of that monographic tradition, and to use the works of other artists and show, really, that one can be remain an author and at the same time take responsibility for the surplus of meaning that a collection of works constructs, which is something art historians don't do, by and large.